Welcome to Cult from the UBC, the culture radio show from your favorite campus newspaper. It's Thursday, March 29th, 2018. I'm Eve O'Day, a staff writer at the UBC.
And I'm Alam Delanian, a staff writer at the UBC as well. This show is broadcasted from CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people. This week we have a very stacked show.
Yes, we do. First off, we talked to UBC staff writer Julia Burnham about hashtag UBC Accountable and the Great Canadian Literature Debacle. Next, with the Jewish holiday of Passover coming up this weekend, we got taken to school with Rabbi Philip Bregman to talk about the holiday.
Yeah, and after that, I talked to Joshua Zizi about the magical Mexican grill known as Chipotle and the tenuous attempts by UBC students to try to bring that to campus. And finally, we have an interview with Celine Onje, the Vice President External of Blank Vinyl Project, BVP. She talked to us about her club and the club's upcoming much-anticipated event called Goose Hunt. But first, I have myself and Julia Burnham discussing the fallout of UBC Accountable and the Great Canadian Literature Debacle. Stay tuned. Here's the show. Since 2015, UBC has been at the center of a very large controversy that has been brewing within the Canadian literature scene. Here to speak with us is the writer of the big piece that came out in the UBC culture section, UBC senior staff writer,
staff writer,
Julia Burnham, here in the studio with us. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Cool. So, yeah, I guess we're just going to, I just want to kind of talk about how the story was kind of formatted. You've been reporting on this for how many months now?
Like four or five months. Yeah.
And then, so basically the story is formatted as the letter, the students, the silence, the fear, and the future. So we're just going to kind of like try to wrap this interview around those ideas. I'll first of all just be like, how did you stumble upon this story?
Yeah, so it was actually pitched out in November, so that was quite a while ago, and the original pitch that we had was just so much different than what it actually turned out to be. Because
what's the original pitch?
The original pitch was just, checking in on, UBC Accountable. We haven't written about Galloway or anything in quite some time, so we wanted to check in.
Do you want to kind of like tell us what that's about? Like the Galloway, just like kind of like draw, walk us through the story of like, yeah, Galloway, UBC Accountable. Yeah.
Yeah, so Galloway was the former creative writing chair. In November of 2015, he was temporarily suspended from the university due to serious allegations that were not elaborated upon.
Quote unquote serious allegations.
Quote unquote, yeah. Serious allegations. And then the sort of like timeline of how things progressed gets a little messy from there on. In June, it was released that he had been permanently suspended from the university because of...
Permanently suspended.
No one's really been saying the word fired, but yeah, he was fired.
Yeah.
So that was the result of a report that UBC had hired a former Supreme Court judge, Miriam Ellen Boyd, to do this report and sort of investigate these claims against Galloway. So as a result, UBC had fired him, citing an irreparable breach of trust. And then the next year, after, everything's sort of on the upswing, they've got new interim chairs. Then in November, all of these...
For some reason, they just had to wait.
Just like exactly a year after all of this happened, they have these writers, like notable writers that everyone knows.
You've got Margaret Atwood.
You've got Michael Ondaatje, Yann Martell, who wrote Life of Pi,
yeah.
Joseph Boyden.
Yeah.
So all of these people sort of band together. And they wrote this open letter to UBC, and it was
hashtag
titled
UBC Accountable.
Hashtag UBC Accountable. So the letter basically asked UBC to give Galloway due process, and they felt that his removal from the university was not handled appropriately, and they would like to see that handled better in the future. Yeah, so
the original story was to like see what, okay, this is a year after what is happening now, and then what did it turn into?
So, yeah, once it hit around, I want to say January, February, things really started to pick up with Canlit in the media cycle, which we weren't expecting. There was a ton of different pieces in The Walrus. I bet a lot of people have read our friend Margaret Atwood's piece, Am I a Bad Feminist? Because a lot of people, once she was getting all this praise for The Handmaid's Tale, they were like, wait, but didn't Margaret Atwood sign that letter? So that sort of got people talking once more. So it kind of turned into...
Do you want to kind of also talk, but I feel like we're jumping around this like thing. Because like, what is like the reason why nobody kind of wants to touch this topic? And like, why is Margaret Atwood seen as, I guess, a bad feminist with respect to like UBC Accountable when she's always been praised from before for being like a good feminist? So could you kind of like explain that a little bit?
So what I've kind of discovered is that Margaret Atwood... It's so difficult to talk about because for so many people that I did talk to in the story, she's been, you know, their lifelong hero and, you know, their feminist literary icon. And now she's kind of writing this letter and standing behind it in many different op-eds. And she's saying what some people have interpreted as, you know, victim blaming and rape culture and...
Basically, like, defending an accused person.
Yes. So Galloway had been accused of various things from sexual assault, having an affair with a student, sexual harassment, bullying, and slapping a student across the face. So a lot of these people were really feeling like it... was controversial for her to sign this letter and also be sort of heralded as this, you know, Handmaid's Tale feminist icon.
Yeah, so then what happened in the writing of the story? Like, after the, I guess, The Walrus piece came out, what happened?
Yeah, so The Walrus had a couple of pieces. One of them was The Unbearable Whiteness of Canlit, which talked a lot about how the main people that are writing in the Canadian literary community are white authors. So that kind of cried for more diversity.
Another dimension.
Yeah. Indigenous writers, like including all of that. And then Zoe Whittall recently had a piece about Canlit has a sexual harassment problem, which was revisited, I think, in the media cycle because of the Me Too moment. So Zoe Whittall's piece made a lot of waves. It was also taken down temporarily from The Walrus within the first like 24 hours it was published.
Wow.
So yeah, these things are super contentious and very, very touchy for people to talk about. And a lot of people are very like trigger happy to sue. So
makes sense.
Yeah.
So we're just going to like try to like dance around those pitfalls. So the next two parts are the students and the silence, right? So kind of, what was your reporting process like? How willing were people to talk to you? And have you seen any kind of like effort to silence people? If so, by who?
I mean, in talking to the students for sure, that was a really, really difficult process. The creative writing department is a really small department.
Yeah. Rigid.
Yeah, like, the students that were kind of at the center of it with Galloway, they would have been, you know, finishing up their degrees at this point in time, or they've already left the university. So it was really hard to track down people. But even more so, it was hard to get people to feel comfortable talking. I had four students in the end who agreed to sit down to an interview, and three of them had requested anonymity and given interviews, you know, with anonymity as, you know, the be-all or end-all for happening. Because they were really afraid that speaking out against this would harm them professionally.
So you finally got to talk to some of them anonymously, right? Were there any anybody else that you spoke to that was interesting, like another perspective that like really added another dimension and like another wrinkle to the story?
I think that the people that I managed to get to talk to, both, like all of them added such a different level. But I think for me, it was really interesting to sit down with Lawrence Hill. Well, sit down. I called him on the phone. He's actually...
He's in the Yukon right now in
a cabin writing his next book. So we had to do a nice phone call for that. But he's actually a creative writing professor at Guelph. So that was interesting to have that perspective. And as well, he was one of the first sort of big names in CanLit to, you know, speak out against this and say, you know, this is wrong. So that was very interesting to have his perspective.
Yeah, I have an interesting quote from him right here. Mm-hmm. It's like, pull quote, what I find offensive about UBC Accountable is that its primary purpose was to defend an accused professor, and it expressed little concern for the students at the heart of the matter, Lawrence Hill. So, yeah, do you want to kind of comment on that?
Yeah, so that I felt was so powerful. And he went on in his interview to sort of talk about how he wasn't going to say anything about UBC Accountable and Stephen Galloway until, you know, he read the letter and he was like, this is
gross,
so offensive that I just have to say something. And he's also, he's a black writer, so he definitely is not sort of the norm of the, you know, white men that are in this CanLit community. And he actually referred to it a couple of times as an old boys club, which I thought was quite interesting as well.
Nice. So I guess what's the story here? What's, if you had to compact the story and you were like telling somebody in an elevator or something, what's like the summary? What's like the crux of this article? What is the thing that everybody needs to take home and like to kind of understand about this entire story?
Ooh, that's loaded. It's... It's hard to compact like 5 months of this work and try and, you know, put it into a couple of sentences. But I really think the difference between this story and everything else that's been sort of reported on Stephen Galloway and UBC Accountable is that this is taking in perspective the students who were at the heart of the scandal. These are the students that sat in the classroom as their professors were signing these letters, and they sat in the classroom as their former chair, you know, was, you know, usurped from the university, and all of these letters were being signed, and everything was happening.
How did that make them feel, right? Yeah.
How did that make them feel? They're trying to enter this Canadian literary community, and they're receiving, like, the vocational training for that.
Yeah.
How do they feel? Like, are their voices being heard? Yeah. Can they, you know, find a way to publish in the end? Like, what's that experience like?
Cool. Are there any, like, I guess, final comments or insights that you kind of gleaned from the reporting process? And, yeah.
I definitely think that we aren't done talking about CanLit. I asked a lot of people if they felt that CanLit was dead. That was one thing that I asked everyone that I interviewed. And I actually had varying answers for, you know, everyone. But I think the future of CanLit is kind of going to leave behind these sort of elite and old boys club, as many people had mentioned to me. But yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens, because I think there's a lot of really great work that's being put out there by different writers from marginalized communities, and that's going to be really interesting to see.
Well, thanks so much, Julia.
Thank you so much.
That was UBC staff writers Alamide Alanian and Julia Burnham talking about her article called We All Fall Down, Creative Writing Students Struggle to Move Past #UBCAccountable and the Crumbling CanLit Community. You can find the article on ubc.ca now.
Yeah, coming up, we have more cool interviews. Next, we have an interview with Rabbi Philip Bregman to talk about Passover.
The true meaning of Passover. It's not all matzah and haroset.
Yes, and we'll be right back after these PSAs. Stay tuned. Don't go anywhere.
The rumor of witchcraft is all about. I think you'd best go down and deny it yourself. The parlor's packed with people, sir. I'll sit with her.
And what shall I say to them? That my daughter and my niece I discovered dancing like heathen in the forest?
Uncle, we did dance. Let you tell them I confessed it, and I'll be whipped if I must be. But they're speaking of witchcraft.
UBC Theater and Film presents The Crucible by Pulitzer Prize winner Arthur Miller.
Join us March 15th to 31st for the last play of the season at the Frederick Wood Theater.
Theaterfilm.ubc.ca.
Allow me to tell you about Unceded Airways.
What's that?
Isn't that some kind of indigenous radio show?
It sure is. Tell me, are you down for decolonization? Yeah. What?
I certainly wish I could hear about indigenous issues, people, and events on the radio.
You're in luck, because Unceded Airwaves talks about all these things and more every Monday morning at 11.
Music from indigenous artists and coverage of all the hot happenings in indigenous art and entertainment.
On CITR 101.9 FM.
Oh, wow. And they broadcast all this from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people?
Find out for yourself. Mm-hmm. Monday mornings at 11. Yeah. Or find episodes online at citr.ca.
Today we're joined in the studio by the Cedar Program Youth.
Where you are at.
You're listening to Cult at the UBC, a culture show from the campus newspaper at the University of British Columbia. We're broadcasting from the unceded Musqueam territories on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Eve O'Day.
And I'm Gina Boyce. Coming up, we have Eve's interview with the Rabbi Philip Bregman about the Jewish holiday known as Passover. Enjoy.
I'm going to give you some matzah.
Free matzah for the year. This Sunday is Easter Sunday, and Easter is great. Really, it is. We get chocolate-shaped eggs, and we have a four-day weekend. But another very important holiday happening this weekend is the beginning of Passover. This is a Jewish holiday that lasts for 8 days. 8 days?
Are you asking me?
I am asking you.
Oh, okay. So it depends, which is always a great answer within Judaism. In our sacred text, the Torah, which is sometimes called the Five Books of Moses, what non-Jews may refer to in part as the Old Testament, it's 7 days. And in fact, in Israel, Passover is 7 days. And for a certain portion of diaspora Jewry, it's 7 days. And for many others, it's 8 days. So it depends, and there's a whole explanation which would take all of our time.
Okay.
And
so, so that voice of wisdom was Rabbi Philip Bregman, the executive director of Hillel at UBC. Welcome, Rabbi.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, little introduction. Where are you from? How did you get into being a rabbi? I don't know if there's a specific word for that.
Yes. So, well, I was. I'm from Ontario, and. Raised in Toronto and did my undergraduate and graduate work there, and then also went to rabbinical school, which is a postgraduate school of 5 years, and came out with a master's degree and what is called ordination. And that actually was in 1975. I was ordained. I came to Vancouver in 1980 with my wife. I was coming, having served serving a congregation just outside of New York, in New Rochelle, New York. I was an assistant rabbi, large congregation, and came out here in 1980 to become the rabbi of Congregation Temple Shalom. And in fact, I was the senior rabbi there for 33 years, retired in 2013. But it was a very, very short-lived retirement, because the very next day I became the executive director of the Jewish student organization called Hillel BC. We're a Jewish student organization that, in fact, serves seven different campuses out here, which also includes UVic and Squamish and Simon Fraser, Kwantlen, Emily Carr, Langara, SFU, and so on. So I've been the executive director for since 2013. This July, I'll be stepping down from that position I'll still be around Hillel in a part-time position as the rabbi and fundraiser, but my wonderful assistant executive director, Sam Heller, will be taking over the day-to-day operations as the executive director.
Okay, so from my experience, the Passover Seder is a very kid-friendly event. I remember it as being one of my favorite times of year, maybe aside from Hanukkah. That was fun, too. We have various kid-distracting elements, such as the hiding of the afikoman, the Seder plate, and then talking about the 10 plagues. It's all very interesting and intriguing for kids. So do you have any fond memories, maybe from childhood or recently, of notable events at a Seder, or maybe during the week when you weren't supposed to eat bread and you did by accident?
Okay, so first of all, for those of not sure what you mean, certain terminology, such as Seder. The word is a Hebrew word which means order, because there's an order to what we do in terms of this celebration. And it is many Jewish holy days and festivals, we might say, are synagogue-based and also home-based. Well, Passover certainly has an element where there is, where the community will come together in the synagogue, but for most Jews, they will probably think of it more as a home-based festival. And on the first night of Passover, we have this, quote, Seder, which is this very elaborate meal, but interwoven are all sorts of customs and traditions. And you're absolutely right. Many of the customs have developed to sort of keep the children alert, occupied, anticipating what's coming next. The main symbol of this holiday is this matzah, which I brought, and of course,
thank you very
all of
much.
Your, which, you know, all of your viewers, of course, can see.
This is not a visual podcast.
I understand. It's this unleavened bread. And at a certain point, towards the beginning of the Seder, we will actually take a piece and break it. And we break it unevenly for a purpose. There's a lot of audiovisual aspects to this holiday. And we can show people, and in particular children, that this matzah, and I'll come back and talk about it in a few moments, it's broken unevenly to show the haves and the have-nots of the world. And you have this where the world is not divided evenly. Even though we have enough resources to feed everybody, we choose as human beings not to. There's no reason for hunger. No reason whatsoever. There's enough food in the world. We just choose not to either share it or distribute it in an equitable fashion. So we have this matzah, we break it, and with the larger piece, we then wrap it up and we hide it, called the afikoman. It's actually a Greek word, which means dessert. Mm. Now, the Greeks at the end of their meals had an orgy, and we end up with a piece of matzah.
I can definitely say that when I was about 8 or 9, finding the afikoman was one of the proudest moments of my life.
Right.
It was right at my eye level. I remember exactly where it was, okay. And I was the youngest there, so I felt right. I felt pretty great.
So at a certain point, we release the hordes, and the children go out, and they try and find it. And usually there's some type of gift that...
For us, it was chocolate.
That then gets redeemed and so on. But I want to get back to the whole aspect of the matzah, because the tradition says that the children of Israel left Egypt after being enslaved for some 400 years. They finally left in haste, and they did not have time for the bread to rise. And so they took this unleavened bread. It became the symbol. I see it as an incredible teaching tool, because really what it represents is a sense of despair. If you take a piece of bread, a normal piece of bread, and let's say you hold it above a table, maybe 4, 5, 6 inches, and let it drop, nothing will generally happen to that bread, assuming it's fresh. But if you take a piece of matzah and drop it, it will break. And it crumbles. And to me, it becomes a visual symbol of so many individuals, and in particular children, who are malnourished in the world. If you push them and they fall down, their bones will break. They're so brittle. So it really becomes a symbol, and it's in Hebrew it's known as lechem oni, the poor person's bread. It's there to remind us that the world is far from whole, and we have a responsibility to make sure that people are, quote, not like matzah in this one instance, that are so frail that they will break. And they can be frail because of malnutrition, but they can also be frail because of psychological issues as well. Now, the other aspect that I like about the matzah is that, you know, normal bread rises, adds yeast, whereas this is very, very flat. What the normal bread has is what I call haughtiness or arrogance. We try to put away for a period of time this arrogance, to take a look inside. It's a very introspective holiday if we want to get to that level beyond the symbols of the food and everything else that goes on.
Yeah, that's very enlightening. I've never thought about matzah as having such a deep meaning, but it definitely does. So for those who don't know, who might be listening, what exactly is Passover celebrating? Where does it originate from?
Well, as I mentioned, coming out of the second book of the Hebrew Bible, in Hebrew Shmot, and the Greek is Exodus, or as we would pronounce it here, Exodus, it talks about the children of Israel leaving Egypt, which is why the Greeks called it exit, going out. And that's what it is symbolizing, our going from, we say, Avadim Hayinu, we were slaves, V'yata b'nei Horin, and now we are free. So it represents this transition from slavery to freedom. Now, we can understand this from a historical point of view, but I think we can also understand this from a very mindful understanding. You see, I believe we're all slaves to something. How many people are slaves to their phones, to their technology, to their email? How many are slaves to fashion? How many are slaves to money and occupation? This idea of slavery is a very, very real thing, I would say, for most, if not all, individuals, ego in particular. So this is a time to really think about that. How do I transition from that which is enslaving me and becoming a little more free in my world? And we use various symbols at the Seder, both which have a historical meaning, but I think today also have a very, very real sense in our lives today. For example, we have something that represents the bitter herbs called maror, usually with a piece of horseradish or something that when you bite it, there's a sting. Mm-hmm. It represents the bitterness of slavery. But it also represents the bitterness of life and the disappointments that we have and illness and pain today. One of the things that this holiday tries to do is really get us to an understanding and an empathy of not only what happened in the past. People have a lot of difficulty remembering. I mean, we're talking about something that happened thousands of years ago. But how empathetic are you in your life today? Are our eyes open or shut? So we take something and it's a little bit of a jolt. Oh, but if we stop there, we really haven't completed the task. If we think about the pain that's around us and we act to try to alleviate it or at least commiserate with it, then we're on a better road.
Wow, you've definitely given me a lot to think about, and I will definitely bring this idea to my Seder, which is happening on Friday night.
Great.
So they're going to be wrapping it up now on a little bit of a lighter note.
Yes.
Have you seen The Prince of Egypt?
Oh, God, years ago. Yes.
Okay. Yes. Just wondering, it's a childhood
one of my favorite films of mine and my sister's. And last thing. Now, yes. I know Passover isn't necessarily a happy celebration, but if you're going to say sort of happy Passover,
I hear what you're saying. It is to the extent that it's happy because it allows for movement. We can get out of slavery, and we can try to be there for other individuals as well. You know, one of my heroes in life, and I actually had the honor and privilege of working with him, was Martin Luther King Jr.
Wow.
When I was much younger, and the African American community for many, many years took this whole aspect of Passover in a very, very real sense. One of the great, great gospel hymns to come out was "Let My People Go." There's a sense of hope, and that is something that we can be joyful about. Anyway, to answer your question, we have a phrase that says "Chag Sameach."
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach, which really means happy holiday.
Yeah.
Or Chag Pesach Sameach, may you have a joyous Passover. And yes, you talked about at the beginning of the program, the confluence this year of Easter and Passover. That happens more often than people realize, because in Christian tradition, actually, the Last Supper was a Passover meal.
Mm. I did not know that.
There you go.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and Chag Pesach Sameach.
Chag Pesach Sameach to you.
That was myself, Eve O'Day, interviewing Rabbi Philip Bregman about Passover. Passover begins on the evening of March 30th and ends on the evening of Saturday, April 7th. We'll be right back, but first, some PSAs.
Well-known pimp, narcotics king, big-time racketeer, back in full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV? My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is here to give you sounds from the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future, and those forgotten classics that need a little rescue.
Yeah. Come on, baby. Come on. I won't let you down. Follow me.
Exploding Head Movies, Monday, 7-9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Sequential Circus has been Vancouver's premier showcase of live electronic music, art, and performance for over a decade. Strap on your dancing shoes and join us for Sequential Circus 22 on Saturday, April 21st at Open Studios. Musical performances by 1800 Hyde Street, Amos Hertzman, Lace, MAAM, and Quest. Visuals by Dermot Glennon, Pixel Pusher, and Ian Ross. An aerial hoop performance by Celine. Tickets are $20. Get more information at sequentialcircus.ca.
Listening to Cult at the UBC, a cultural show from the campus newspaper at the University of British Columbia. We're broadcasting from the unceded Musqueam territories on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Gina Boyce.
And I'm Eve O'Day. Up next, UBC staff writer Alamide Alanian and Joshua Azizi talk about Chipotle, or as my mom says, Chipotle, and the tenuous attempts by UBC students to bring it to campus. Enjoy!
Hey everyone, it's Alamide here. Here with me in the studio, it's Joshua Azizi, UBC senior staff writer. He wrote an article about the long and tenuous odyssey to get the magical Mexican grill, Chipotle, to the UBC campus, right?
Yes, although
unlike the Odyssey, Chipotle was never here. Ooh. And at this point, I don't know if it's coming, if it's ever going to come here.
Yeah, that's heartbreaking.
You can't see it, but I'm wiping a tear out of my eye right now.
Well, let's start from the beginning, right?
We'll start from the beginning.
So not many brands can come back from an E. coli outbreak. I know you can't really talk much about that, like environmental hazards and all that kind of stuff, but...
See, I'm just kind of a mindless, ignorant consumer. I don't know much about their E. coli outbreaks.
Okay, cool. But could you just explain what Chipotle is to the listeners and why the brand is so appealing as a restaurant?
So why the brand is so appealing as a restaurant? I mean, I feel like everyone would have their own different take, but when I went there for like kind of the first time a few weeks ago, it's like standard Mexican grill food, so like tacos, burritos.
Wait, so you hadn't been there until like recently?
Actually, yeah, not until recently. In fact, I haven't been there until after I wrote the article.
Interesting.
And then when I went there, it was like a religious experience.
So basically you were objective in the actual reporting of the article, but now mm-hmm. you have all the opinions about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I mean, I was still praiseworthy of it anyways, just to, like, you know, get that silly blog voice.
Yeah.
And, you know, give the people what they want. But yeah. then I actually tried it, and it was so good.
Yeah, so Chipotle.
I could not believe how good it was. I was blown away.
Stunned, yeah.
Absolutely stunned.
Talk to me about Chipotle, man.
Okay, it's like, I don't know, what I like about it is that it's almost kind of like the Subway of Mexican food, and that you can, like, put in what you want.
Yeah.
You want steak, you want beans, you want rice, it's all up to you.
Yeah.
And the ingredients are really good, like the steak meat is just, oh man.
So it's like this kind of like interesting customizable nature of it is what makes the brand mm-hmm. like, is appealing to most people, right?
Yeah, and they have great spicy salsa as well.
Mm,
I don't know, I like to burn the hell out of my mouth with spicy food.
Fair enough.
I don't know why, it's just, I find it appealing.
Cool. So I understand you have, I guess, a burning feeling when it comes to Mexican food. There are three other Mexican food mm-hmm. restaurants on campus. What are those, what are your takes on them, and why aren't students satisfied with those, and why do they want to have Chipotle on campus?
Okay, well, first when we start this out, I want to bring this back to you. I want a taco. You said you didn't like it, Ola.
Well, you don't air me out on like radio right now, but
I think
is good in some respect, but a lot of their other stuff, like I mean their actual tacos are, I mean for me personally, I don't want to like give anybody takes, mm-hmm. but I don't find it satisfactory. Especially like their fish and stuff, like it's not something to write home about. But their burrito is actually good. It's just really pricey as well. So yeah.
But let's talk about the most important thing here, the quesadillas.
The quesadillas. I've tried the quesadillas. They're okay. I think one of the reasons why I'm not impressed with I Want a Taco is because it's just okay. It's like, if you're going to make me spend, like, you know, $10 for mm-hmm. a thing, like, you need to really, like, blow me out of the water, you know? I can probably get, like, something that fills me more from the deli.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know... I don't know. And like Taco Mio probably is like around the same price and it's like 10 times better, right? Not 10 times better, but it's like kind of better.
Oh, Taco Mio is more expensive. But
exactly.
It is
yeah.
better.
But it's like $1 more expensive. Mm-hmm. Like it's like, and it is like slightly like better quality.
Yeah,
so,
it's a lot better quality.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, you also had opinions about the other. So talk to me about the other places.
Taco Mio, when I wrote the article, I'd only been to Taco Mio like once or twice and I wasn't very impressed with it. And so I dissed them in the article. I was like, yeah, instead of Chipotle, we got Taco Mio, whatever the hell that is. And then, but I've been going back there. It's really good.
Oh, yeah. They are very good. And they have, like, all the, like, Jarritos. It's, like, this mm-hmm. soda drink and everything. It's, like, very, very good stuff, yeah.
And they have, like, you know, mild, medium, and hot sauce. Their hot sauce is really strong.
Yeah. So is that why you go in there, because of the hot sauce? Or
it's one of the biggest appeals.
Okay.
Like, I just, it destroys my mouth.
That's good.
And I love it, though. Nice. I love it, though.
And then I guess it's like Red Burrito.
I actually have never been to Red Burrito.
Hmm. Okay, so you have no takes on that.
This is a new love of mine, and so okay. I still need to explore. I still need to find myself in this regard.
All right.
In fact, I'm going to drop a bombshell. I only had my first burrito a few weeks ago.
Wow.
It was amazing.
So, yeah, just question. Just like, why do you think students aren't satisfied with those options?
I'm not really sure.
Your experience reporting on this phenomenon.
Okay, I think I'm going to use one of my favorite analogies, the Lego and Mega Bloks analogy.
Okay.
Chipotle is Lego. Everyone knows what it is. Everyone loves it. And all the other brands are Mega Bloks or like some other imitation of Lego.
Gotcha.
Does similar things, but it's not the main one that gets all the love.
It's like the brand name. It's like, yeah, no, that makes sense.
But it lives up to the popularity, too, because Chipotle is better than them all.
Yeah, fair enough.
And so, you know, students want the Lego. They don't want the Mega Bloks.
Fair enough. Okay, so what do we know about the first, I guess, contagion outbreak of this Chipotle fever on campus? Like, yeah, no. That first time that this idea, this dangerous idea, really took, like, a real form.
So someone posted in UBC Confessions saying that their mother was, that she worked for Chipotle, and that, or I don't remember exactly what it was. Yeah, I think it was that her mother worked for Chipotle.
Yeah, and guaranteed that like, there would be a Chipotle on mm-hmm. campus by September.
And then...
It's 2016. Yeah.
And then on Facebook, Gurveer Sangha...
Former student senator.
Former student senator, UBC. Gurveer, he... said that Veronica Knott, who was a Board of Governors member, he said that she gave him the get-go to say, you know, I wrote that, and that my mom confirmed that Chipotle is, like, very likely going to be opening something up.
Yeah.
And, you know, huge outbreak of applause.
Yeah.
You know, everyone tagging their friends, saying, yeah, this is awesome.
Yeah, but also just, like, a disclaimer that, like, AMS election season was happening at that point, mm-hmm. and, like, endorsements were happening as well, and, like... Veronica Knott did not respond to the post, actually, so, like, it feels like...
She did heart react it, though.
Yeah, she did heart react
it. She gave it that heart react.
Yeah, so it could be just completely, like a banter.
Oh, totally.
And, like, just trolling, to be honest, so...
This is dirty... If there was no substance behind it, some dirty politics.
That's just some dirty politics. It's just, like, making promises... Like, normal politician stuff, making
the
promises.
The UBC equivalent of collaborating with Russia.
Yes.
We're spreading fake news.
Cambridge Analytica. okay, so the idea never died, right? We both know that Reddit, mm-hmm. One of the internet websites where people get a lot of news
of toxicity,
from.
Toxicity.
Well, it can also be a really amazing place, actually.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But we know that they are an unforgiving and vindictive group, mm-hmm. Especially on UBC. So,
I had someone lash out at me once there, actually. It was brutal. Something like, I made some sort of mistake that I can't really remember right now, and they were like, God, there's no... No wonder this paper can't produce a decent article to save their lives.
Wow. Drag him.
No, I was just... And then he made another comment when I responded politely, and he said a really bad word that I shouldn't repeat on air. And then when I went back, I noticed that he edited his comment and took that word out. I was like, I saw what you did there.
Yeah.
I saw what you did there.
So can you talk to me about like the Reddit reactions to the Chipotle adventure?
Yeah, Reddit just seems to really like it.
Yeah.
They just have made at least like 6 threads commenting on it, and so it's kind of, it's an old beaten issue at this point.
The horse that refuses to die.
Kind of, it just refuses to die. And I don't think we're really making any progress on it either. So, who knows?
But just following that up, like, I mean, AMS, both the UBC president and the AMS president have both responded to questions about Chipotle.
Mm-hmm.
Different opinions about what's happening. I think Santa Ono, UBC president Santa Ono, had an AMA, not about Chipotle, but that's where the conversation went, the logical conclusion.
Naturally.
But he more or less kind of confirmed it. Could he kind of talk about that a little bit?
I think he said he was in talks about it, but it was open-ended enough that it wasn't really confirming. So it was kind of, you know... He doesn't commit to anything, but at the same time, he gives the people what he wants, which is a very, I guess, good tactic-wise on his behalf. But not really a commitment there. And as we saw, nothing's come out of it so far. And then Alan Ehrenholz was like, yeah, there's
AMS
no talk.
President.
AMS president Alan Ehrenholz, he was basically just like, we have no plans for this, but go to I Want a Taco.
Shameless self-promotion.
Shameless self-promotion.
Like... Yeah, no.
He's trying to help out AMS businesses.
Fair enough. Yeah, I do like their tater tots. Like their I Want a Taco's tater tots are really good. But those don't count as like.
I might have to disagree.
You disagree
on that.
With that? We'll disagree.
They're good
that,
junk
sure.
food. They're good junk food.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Okay. So, any final comments or like insights or observations to make about just the entire timeline and the likelihood of Chipotle actually making it to campus.
Probably unlikely. There was also some comment I saw on the internet about someone saying that UBC was actually in talks with them, but that it fell out because UBC wanted UBC Food Services to run it. I don't know where that guy was getting that.
I mean, it might be an insider, right? Maybe
could be an insider.
Who's the person?
I don't know. It was someone on Reddit with some weird username. So, you know, I don't really know where we can trace that back from.
It could be everything or it could be nothing.
But at the same time, that's like a very highly specific thing to say.
Yeah, exactly.
Who knows? I don't know.
Yeah. Get at us. My email. You can find my email somewhere, probably. I don't know. Don't email me. Actually, email the culture editor. If you have any tips on what is happening for Chipotle and the UBC campus, email us at one of the UBC editors, and we'll investigate it to its logical conclusion.
Or you can email me at joshuaazizi@yahoo.ca.
Actually, give your Twitter.
Oh, yeah, I do have Twitter. It's just my name, Joshua Azizi. I have a cat wearing a cowboy hat as my Twitter picture.
Nice. Very cool.
Very cool. I'm so cool.
Well, thank you so much, Joshua.
I have no followers. Please follow me.
Well, thank you so much, Joshua.
No problem. Thank you.
Okay, those were UBC's staff writers, Olamide Olanyan and Joshua Azizi, talking about Josh's article about Chipotle and the tenuous attempts by UBC students to bring it to campus. Josh wrote about it for the UBC blog. You can check it out online at ubc.ca.
We'll be right back, but first some ads and PSAs.
Momentum. It's the annual end-of-year showcase. Come watch the UBC Ballet Club competitive and recreational teams perform alongside guest performances from other UBC dance clubs on Saturday, March 31st at 6:30 p.m. in the South Great Hall of the Nest. Entry is only $5 for UBC students and $7 for everyone else. Each ticket comes with a free raffle ticket for sweet prizes. Additional raffle tickets can be bought separately, and all tickets can be purchased through one of our execs or at the door. See you there.
This is Cult at the UBC, the culture show from the campus newspaper at the University of British Columbia. We're broadcasting from the unceded Musqueam territories on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Eve O'Day.
And I'm Gina Boyce. Coming up, we have our last interview. UBC staff writer Olamide Olanyan interviews the VP external of the Blank Final Project, BVP, Celine Unje. She talks to him about her club and its upcoming event, Goose Hunt. Enjoy.
As a musician on the UBC campus, finding a group to jam with or appreciate music with can be very hard, and that can feel incredibly isolating. But thankfully, the Blank Final Project, or BVP, is here to solve that. So I'm here with Celine Onje, the Vice President External of the BVP. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Cool. I'm so sorry. just right off the gate, common misconception about the name. How often does the organization, I guess, get referred to as Black Vinyl Project? And if you had a dollar for every time that somebody referred to your club by the wrong name, how rich would you be?
We'd definitely be the richest club on campus, for sure.
For sure.
Yeah, I think some of our members even call it Black Vinyl Project sometimes. Some of our execs slip up.
Honest mistake. Cool. I know like the BVP, I guess, seeks to create a community for music lovers and musicians on campus. What exactly does that entail? What is like the week-to-week activities that the club does? And I mean, how does that foster the community that you seek to create?
Yeah, for sure. So we offer a lot of services to musicians. We have a jam space and a build-a-band program where we can bring musicians together if they're interested in forming groups. And we also offer recording, videography, and photography for those musicians. But more importantly, we have activities where we try and bring out people who just enjoy music and want to be a part of a music community but don't necessarily play can come and interact. So we have jam sessions for musicians, but we also have open mics, which obviously anybody can attend, and we have songwriter sessions for people who are interested in learning a little bit more about writing, and we have producers mixers, which we do at the EDM club. So for people who are interested in more of the like audio tech kind of side. We do our open mics every other week, and our songwriter sessions are also every other week, producers mixer every other week.
So I guess this is like stuff for like every single level of experience, and also like what kind of music you're interested in.
Yeah, for sure. A common misconception is like if you are a musician that you're not like good enough for Blank Vinyl Project, and that's like not true at all. Like if you're even just a beginner, we definitely encourage you to come out, check out what we have. We also have like fun, just like music swaps. And we had a house party last year, or last semester.
Cool.
And we have Goose Hunt coming up, which obviously you don't need to play to come and enjoy some good music.
Sure. Yeah. We're just going to go back all the way back. I know off, like before we started the interview, you mentioned that you were playing violin since you were five. Mm-hmm. You've been playing, I guess, music for a while. What's your like first experience with the Blank Vinyl Project? Just talk to me about that a little bit.
Yeah, so my first experience was in first year on Imagine Day. I saw their booth, and I didn't really get what it was. They had, like, vinyls hanging up, and I was like, this looks like it could be interesting. Maybe it's, like, a music swap group or some kind of something. I don't know. So I went and talked to them, and they were having a bonfire at Rec Beach that night, and they kind of told me a little bit about the club. They asked me if I played. And so I went to the bonfire, and they had some bottles of wine, and someone brought a guitar, someone brought a ukulele, someone had a cajon, and
it's a cajon.
It's like a box that you can drum on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And so we all just jammed and sang, and it was like very like feel good, and it was like the first moment at UBC where I like was like, yes, this was a good decision for me to come to this school.
Nice.
Yeah, it was like the first moment where I felt like connected to the UBC community. So BVP like has meant a lot to me right from the very beginning.
So I guess that's like the moment where you realize that you love the club and like you wanted to stay, and I guess 4 years. What year are you in actually?
I'm in my fourth year.
Okay, 4 years down the line, you're still there and like you still want to give to it. And I guess afterwards, you probably would still be interested.
I think that's like one of the really powerful strengths that BVP has, is all of the execs are so dedicated to the club, and everybody who, like all of the alumni of the club, still care passionately about the club, and everybody tries to contribute as much as they can for as long as they can.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Okay, so just like a switching of gears, I know you were a violinist for the band If Not Winter.
You did your research.
Well, it's not really that much research. I mean, that's like the first thing that comes up with your name. So, I know like you guys won the Last Band Standing contest, and you played at Block Party. Mm-hmm. I understand that the group met through Blank Vinyl Project.
Yeah.
Could you kind of talk a little bit about that, how you all just like came together?
Yeah, for sure. So I joined the Build-A-Band program in my second year, and I met Sawyer, the bassist, through that. We were put in a group together with a few other musicians, but our group didn't really go anywhere. And then the lead singer of that group actually formed
Build-A-Band group.
He formed a group with Grace and with Sawyer.
Who was the person of the lead singer from the
Gert Build-A-Band? Gert Berner.
Okay, cool.
So he formed a group with them, and then and our drummer actually, Nick, our original drummer,
Babe.
Nick. Babe, yeah. And they played with Gert's music for a while, and then Grace wanted to branch out and do her own stuff, so she asked them to help her out with that. And then so it was Grace, Sawyer, Nick Babe were the original trio. And then Sawyer asked me to join. And then Sam actually saw them perform.
Yeah.
And then she approached them after the show and was like, wow, you guys are amazing. Do you want a keyboardist? Because I'd want to be a part of this.
It's a very organic group that just, like, I guess, adapts. Yeah.
Yeah, and then Nick went on exchange. So we had Neil step in as drummer while he was gone. And now Neil's definitely, like, a fundamental member of the group.
Drummer, yeah.
Yeah, he's our drummer now.
Would you see that that's like one of the prime examples of kind of like what the BVP can do, I guess, in like forming relationships and stuff?
Yeah, for sure. Most of my like close friends are also I've met through BVP. It's like really easy to make friendships when you are already and you already have like this thing that you're all so passionate about, which is music. Like not necessarily the club, but just music in general. Like musicians are all very passionate people.
And music is kind of like a universal language, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
So even like you have to like bridge, you know, I guess cultures and like, you know, religions and all that kind of stuff.
Faculty.
Like, exact faculty, you know, like you can bridge that like way more easily with music than
any
other, I guess, activity probably, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So can you kind of talk to me a little bit about the club's origins? Do you know anything about that? Founders?
How
did it start off? And what's the journey been like since then?
Sure. I've actually met the founder of the club, Ben Chen.
Okay.
He's incredible. He's a very organized and talented person.
I guess you have to be, yeah.
Yeah. But when he was originally making this club, it was because the only music clubs on campus were not catering towards like live music performance, really.
What were these clubs?
I think at the time there was Jazz Cafe.
Okay.
I know UMI hadn't formed yet. I'm not sure if there was anything else.
What's UMI? Sorry.
University, I don't know,
Music
actually.
Institute? I have
music,
no idea.
Music Initiative.
Guess.
Music Initiative.
There we go, there
I think
we
it's
go,
University.
It.
Ugh, I really should know that. It's just UMI.
No worries.
He formed this group with some of his friends from Sauter, and they were originally going to call it Sauter Music Project. Thank God they did not do that.
Alienating.
Yeah, exactly. And it was originally meant to be a platform for musicians to get out of the UBC community and perform like bigger venues. It was meant to be a like music production kind of deal. And so there was originally auditions, which I think actually has really stuck with BVP. Like, people still ask us whether or not they need to audition to be a part of the community. And we're like, what? No, you don't even need to play.
So when did that, like, switching of gears happen? Like, so I think it, like a more outwards looking to, like, a more UBC-focused one?
Yeah. So the transition from, like, a recording platform to a community has been kind of slow. I think it took them about 2 years to realize that the recording platform idea wasn't that viable here, and so the club's been around for 9 years, I believe, and so the first 2 years they were definitely leaning towards the recording platform thing, and then it slowly has been transforming ever since. I think it was really the focus of the club when Neil Saini was president last year to really like facilitate that community feeling and try and eliminate any of that stigma that we're an exclusive club for professional musicians and try and focus more on just being a community of music lovers.
Yeah. So was it Ben that like created the name, the BVP, or was it like the change somewhere along the line?
No, it was the first year they did end up picking Blank Vinyl Project, him and his team. I think they just all came up with a bunch of ideas and voted on what they liked, and Blank Vinyl Project stuck.
Nice. Very cool. Yeah, so I guess we can talk about Goose Hunt now. I know you're like pressed to talk about. Yeah, so what is Goose Hunt? I know, like, I've seen that a lot. I know there's face paint involved.
And, there is face paint. Yes, that yes. is my
thing. That was your idea.
So.
Okay, cool. Okay, hit us with your spiel.
Okay, so Goose Hunt is a student-run music festival. It's the largest in Vancouver. I mean, we could probably even say largest in BC. I don't know of any other student-run music festivals. But it's this year it's 10 bands and 2 DJs. And
who's
7
playing?
Hours. We have who's playing?
Who's playing?
Maze Theory, If Not Winter.
Okay.
Clute, nice. Who has recently renamed themselves to Marine Drive. They won the Last Band Standing this year.
Nice.
We've got Los Buenos as one of our DJs.
That's stacked.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot. I can't think of all of them off the top of my head, but
so what is it? Just like all of them playing for like, I guess, an hour each over the entire period, or?
No, it's so we've got an indoor stage and an outdoor stage, and so it kind of alternates between the two stages, so that way there's like no real downtime. You can go from one stage to the other, and they've got time to set up in between. So I think they're about 30-minute sets for most. I think the DJs have a little longer, and yeah, you just
it sounds fun. It sounds really fun. So could you tell us when it's happening? And,
yeah, for sure.
What to expect.
Okay. Yeah. It's this Saturday.
Yeah.
And it's doors are at 6 and music starts at 7.
Okay.
And it goes until late.
Okay. Cool. Late. Cool.
Past 12.
What's your like experience with Goose Hunt? I know you have to say positive things, right? But like,
oh, I would say positive things regardless.
Okay, cool. Like, what was like the first time? I guess you was Goose Hunt there when you first joined the club, or
I think
is it more
had,
recent thing?
Yeah, I think they had Goose Hunt. Goose Hunt has definitely been here since the origin of BVP, basically. But I think it started either the second or third year of BVP's existence. I think it was the third. And my experience started when I was in my second year. I didn't go in first year. Second year I went just to watch. Okay. And then last year we performed, and this year we're performing.
Nice.
But yeah, it's always so much fun. There's just a ton of people who just like really get into the music, and people who just come to hang out too. Yeah. So like, you don't have to be crazy with music. Yeah. You can just, it's like, it's that kind of music festival vibes where you can like come to enjoy and just like hang out with your friends, have fun. There's activities, there's a barbecue, there's...
Oh, food.
Yeah.
That was UBC staff writer Alameda Alanion interviewing Celine Unje about the BVP and their upcoming live music festival, Goose Hunt.
Yeah, definitely check it out. It's going to be this Saturday, March 31st at Kerner's Pub. You find tickets for this event online. And that's the show for the week. Thanks to Alameda Alanion, Julia Burnham, Rabbi Philip Bregman, Joshua Azizi, and Celine Unje for coming on the show.
The music for this episode was Knock Knock by Poddington Bear from the Free Music Archive. If you missed part of the show or just want to check out other episodes, you can find our podcast at citr.ca.
Don't miss us too much. We'll be back in 2 weeks. I'm Gina Boyce.
And I'm Eve O'Day. Goodbye, everyone.